Hi, Patrick Cox in the World Newsroom in Boston with Carol Hills this week to talk language news. Here's what we have. Autocrats with accents, despots with dialects. Looting, how do you say that in Japanese? Can you say it in Japanese? Fingerspelling, yes, it too is on the endangered language list. Love, war, and matrimony, conveyed in the shorthand of cartoons. And how to turn Inuit into a single language understood by people spread out over thousands of miles. That and some Scottish-English bathroom talk coming up. Here we are again. Carol?
I'm back. You? I'm back. I'm ready. I'm tanned, rested, and ready.
Whoa.
Let's go. Woo!
Okay. Well, we got five fantastic subjects to talk about today. And Carol, you've got the first one.
I've got the first one. And it's about dictators. And there's nothing funny about dictators. But there is something interesting in the fact that a number of famous dictators, including a current one, they lead countries, but they themselves are from a minority within that country. You got Stalin. He's Georgian, not Russian.
Mm.
You got Hitler, Austrian, not German. You've got Gaddafi, who is, I guess apparently by his very name, Muammar Gaddafi, he's from a particular Bedouin tribe. And his last name, Gaddafi, is sort of like, it's like saying, Patrick, I'm from this part of Ireland. You know, it's like as if your last name says where you're from, that you're that you are this person
right.
from this minority.
Embedded in the name. Yeah.
Totally. And so him uttering his name is a reminder to people that, yes, I'm from this tribe. Don't mess with me. Don't mess with me, but it's very much a part of his identity, a part of his name. With the way it translates, literally and figuratively, is that when he speaks, his Arabic is noticeably a particular dialect. And lots of Libyans can't understand it. And this is kind of an old chestnut in Arabic, and we've discussed it on the show, I'm sure you have in the podcast, which is the Arabic that's spoken is so different from
right.
the Arabic that people learn as a second language.
Right. We want to do a little bit more of that in the podcast because this is an emerging theme with all of these uprisings and calls for more equality.
Yes, yes. And so when Libyans hear Muammar Gaddafi speak, they're sort of like tilting their head going, what? And it's not just because of spoken Arabic versus Arabic, modern standard Arabic, but it's also his particular dialect within Libya. So it's kind of this interesting feature. And I suspect that what is translated from Gaddafi's speeches, which we all go, oh, it's so weird. What's he talking about? Oh, it sounds so weird. There is something, he's not just saying weird things, that if they're in his dialect or in Arabic, they're not as weird as we think they are.
Right.
They're allusions to things that are known from literature or fables or whatever. But it's not as wacky as we in the West think it is.
Right, right.
But I digress. There's other dictators. Would you like to interject here?
Well, I was just wondering about Hitler and Stalin and Napoleon, some of these other people, whether, here's maybe one for the listeners, which I suppose is code of saying we don't know the answer to this question. But here's one for the listeners. When Napoleon spoke French, did people in Paris just go, you know, what is this bumpkin talking about? Or, you know, when Hitler spoke German, was it an Austrian inflected German? I have no idea. Did they all sound like they were sort of outsiders from outside? And because of that, you know, doing a bit of pop psychology here, was there a kind of self and other thing going on? It made it more acceptable for the population to accept these atrocities that were being committed because they weren't by someone who was one of their own.
It's interesting. What you see a lot when you kind of read about this in the cursory way I've done to prepare for this, which is that there's a kind of zeal of the convert quality to it. I don't know about Napoleon. Who can really know? As a boy, he spoke Italian and the local Corsican language. He started speaking French when he was around 9.
Right.
He reportedly, he always had a strong accent. But I assume when you're an emperor, nobody laughs at you. Or if they do, that's quietly.
That's right. Unless Monty Python makes a movie about it.
And you don't have to address the whole country. You know, you're just kind of talking to those people around you.
Right.
Apparently, Hitler, he had an Austrian accent, but the Austrian accent he had was like neighboring Bavaria, a part of Germany. So his accent wasn't entirely foreign to German speakers. It was Bayerisch, or, you know, the heavy Bavarian accent.
Mm.
What people say is that he was intelligible. It wasn't like, oh, he's some freak. But apparently Hitler trilled his R's rather than turning them. Mm. It wasn't the German way. He was a politician who could adapt his speech to his own audience.
Right, right.
So
right.
He had that skill.
Yeah.
Stalin, that's a different thing. I mean, Georgian and Russian have nothing to do with each other. When he was young, he was known, of course, as Iosep Besarionis Dzhugashvili. He had the Vili thing because he's Georgian. So Iosep Besarionis Dzhugashvili, he learned Russian when he was 10. And then he became Stalin a little bit later than that. But so he had 10 years on this planet speaking his native Georgian. Mm. And so he clearly had an accent. And apparently people made fun of him, of course, quietly to themselves. I'm trying to think of other dictators, but it is interesting. It's kind of the zeal of the convert, or it's I'm from this outlier place and now I'm in charge and move over.
Right.
But what is interesting is that in these cases, there's not an attempt to elevate their native tongue. It's not like I'm in charge, so now you're all going to learn Georgian.
Yeah, of Corsica.
No, 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 no. No.
All right. Well, let's move on to the next subject, and that is just a couple of things that I saw on the big story in Japan and the way that it's being reported and some of the issues that people are having with the Japanese language, which very, very few foreign reporters there speak or understand. And they have a real problem because there's not a huge number of Japanese people, especially those affected in northern Japan, who understand any English. So a lot is being done through translators, and there's a lot of misunderstandings. And one of the most interesting linguistic ones was this idea that the Japanese had no word for looting. And this was supposed to indicate that, you know, I don't know if the cart came before the horse or what, whether the Japanese had no concept of looting and so therefore had no word for it, or somehow had no word for it, so had never sort of conceived of the idea of looting. But this came from the fact that there was no looting in the aftermath to the tsunami. Now, this actually is complete rubbish. There are a lot of Japanese words that cover looting, and our friends at Language Log and their readers, the posters, have added a whole load of them. There's a word, dorobo, which means robber. There is goto, which means robbery. Excuse my Japanese pronunciation. I'm going to really mangle this one. Ryakudatsu. It means pillage or plundering or looting. Oh, yeah, here's one. Kajibadorobu. That is a noun meaning a looter at the scene of a fire.
Hmm.
That's pretty specific. So, and that might even indicate that such things took place in Japan in the past. There's like a lot of words that cover in one way or another the act of looting. So, and this brings us on to a larger question about language and this assumption that a lot of people have that there is no word in language X for
exactly
X. And this happens a lot. And it seems that nearly always people get caught out, that then somebody else comes along and says, well, actually there is. You know, there's a book that's just come out by a guy called Robert Lane Green. I'm actually going to be talking to him in a future pod. The book's called You Are What You Speak. And he picks up on this. He read a book by Bill Bryson that made a whole load of claims, among them that the French, for example, didn't really have proper words for either house or home. They just had a word, maison, that covered both of them. So therefore, they had no concept of the difference between house and home, which is absurd, actually. And the word is just used contextually, and it's quite clear what it means.
Apparently, they have no word for entrepreneur either. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the Germans have no word for schadenfreude. Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, it seemed to me that the whole looting thing in Japan really pointed to a big, big problem there is with outsiders trying to figure out what's going on in Japan and what's going on inside the minds of these Japanese victims and not really having access, cultural access to that. We interviewed a doctor. He's a Chicago-based doctor, but he was born in Japan on the Big Show. His name is Mutsuo Ikuhara. He went over to Japan a few days after the earthquake. He's now, I believe he's still in Sendai, you know, working with the International Medical Corps to help out. And he's talked to a number of these victims, and he talks specifically about how he brings his knowledge of Japanese culture and language to bear when it comes to figuring out what it is that they need. Here's a little clip of him talking about that.
From my Western perspective, Japanese people may look very stoic, so a lot of times I may miss what they're really conveying. But if I really listen carefully, look at the subtle cues that as a Japanese person I can pick up on, it can be simply just a simple phrase, a sigh, as it were. These kind of small cues can really be sort of a window to the real degree of, let's say, pain or suffering that they're going through.
So there you go. It just goes to show that we outside journalists, when we go to a place like that, we're really scratching at the surface.
Totally.
And the health workers, too. I mean, it's really, really tough.
Yeah. It's also interesting because that part of Japan is a huge elderly population. When we interviewed on The Big Show, a Japanese editor, he said, that's one of the first things, oh, that place is known for its elderly population. So that also has an effect, I think, in the degree to which people are talking, what their concerns are.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. It's different. It's not like Tokyo.
No. And just to maybe end this little Japan segment on a slightly lighter touch, last week, anybody who listened to the pod last week will have heard the Nuclear Reactor Boy anime that, Carol, you first sent my way that has now gone totally viral.
Really?
Yeah. It's gone so viral that, in fact, there is now a copycat video. It's actually the same images with a different audio track in Scottish English.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, it's pretty well done, actually. I must say, let me just play you a little clip. For anybody who doesn't know about this video and hasn't heard or seen any bits of it, Nuclear Reactor Boy is the main character in it, and he's a little boy who is very flatulent, and there's concern that he may poop. This is a way of describing to children how the nuclear situation is playing out. So let me play you a little bit of the Scottish-English version.
Nuclear reactor boys' jobbies are very smelly. If they come out, everyone will be in big trouble. He's trying his best, but everyone is worried when they hear a loud noise coming from his bum.
Did nuclear reactor boy drop a jobby?
But a quick measure of the smell level around him reveals it wasn't so smelly. So it wasn't a jobby after all. Just a fart. But nuclear reactor boys...
Nice to hear the word bum once in every while. I think
it is.
It's not used that much in this country. But
no, it's not.
Yeah.
In this office it is, though.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, those of us from the old country.
Mum, bum.
Jobbies, not so much. Okay, well, Carol, back to you for the next one.
Well, this is kind of a cool story, and it goes to a subject that I think you've covered a fair amount on the podcast, and we've discussed here to some degree, which is what constitutes a language. Basically, in the Highland country of Scotland.
Scotland.
Yes. Yeah. There's a lot, or not a lot, there are older people who happen to be deaf. There is still a number of them who, instead of using sign language, they spell things out with their fingers. Most parts of the world, there are sign language which is different according to the place you grew up in, but sign language is really the way deaf people communicate.
Right.
So in the Highland part of Scotland, there are still people left who spell things out with their fingers. And there's this project there to document this and to film people and to document it as here's something that is dying out. And here's something that we sort of consider a language. And so there's videotaping and filming these people as a way to preserve this method of communicating that was the way people used to communicate. The people who are doing this project, they've been interviewing 15 people in the Highlands of Scotland who still use their fingers to spell words. And this one woman, she went to the Milan Deaf Olympics in 1957, and she was chatting using her fingers to spell words with an American, and she spelled the word lemonade, and the American was shocked because it was what she was using her fingers to spell was really a rude word according to her. I don't know what rude, what naughty word, but she was like, ugh. So it's sort of interesting, number one, that there was a Milan Deaf Olympics in 1957,
let alone
spelling with your fingers. And, of course, if you use your fingers to spell words instead of signing, it takes a lot longer.
Yeah,
so it was a slower and more cumbersome way of communicating.
The word lemonade, would take a couple seconds.
But it's kind of interesting. It's interesting that this was a way to communicate. I mean, I remember growing up, I knew a couple people whose parents were deaf. And this was sort of, it was kind of before sign language was the way to communicate. And it was more lip reading. So I was surprised to read this, that sort of spelling things out with your fingers it just didn't even occur to me that this would be a way to communicate.
Wow, that's really interesting. And if we are going to call it a language, this is very much an endangered language.
Totally.
So how is it going to be preserved?
Well, in some ways, the researchers who were taking on this project, they equate it with efforts to preserve Gaelic and Welsh and things like that, that this is something that... And in fact, far fewer people use their fingers to spell words and, mm-hmm. and sign than people in the UK who speak Gaelic and Welsh. And that was an impetus to do this project. So I think they're, you know, filming them, and it's going to be one of these things that's going to be in an archive because...
It's going.
You know, they're like shakers. You know, it's like, it's going. There's not... Nobody being replicated who are learning this way of communicating when they're deaf.
Mm-mm. Right.
Excuse me, shakers. There are a few shakers in Maine, and they decided to become shakers, just to clarify. Sorry.
The shaker community was
sorry,
just
shaker community.
Getting ready. You know. Okay, well, if they do archive it, there's not a radio story, yeah. but it'd be great to follow up on that.
Yeah, they very much wanted to film it because it's obviously such a visual thing.
Right. Okay, well, on to the next story. And Carol, I just thought I would take advantage of your presence here to talk a little bit more about cartoons. Again, in the podcast last week, there was the conversation that you and Lisa Marlins had about the cartoons about Japan. This week, there is a very different cartoon story out there from the BBC that I'll play in a couple of minutes about the Cartoon Museum in London that is showing... It's putting on an exhibition on marriage. This is to coincide with something that I'm ashamed to say that I had to look up because I have absolutely zero interest in it, and that is the royal wedding.
William and Kate.
I didn't know it. Firstly, I didn't know it was Prince William. I didn't know which prince it was. And I didn't know Kate. I mean, and I didn't know April 29. I knew nothing. so anyway, now I know a lot. I know way more than I need to know. Let me just tell you a little bit about this story that we're going to hear. The word council house is going to come in, and that of
which is public housing.
That is public housing,
British style.
British style. That's right. So this is a story that is reported by a BBC reporter called Nicola Stanbridge, and it takes the form of really a conversation at the Cartoon Museum with one of the best known British newspaper cartoonists, Steve Bell of The Guardian. So here goes.
The Cartoon Museum is hanging and framing about 100 cartoons dating from 1745 to now. Satirical, ironic, and ribald. Prudes beware.
Love and marriage, love and marriage, go together like a horse and carriage.
Steve Bell, cartoonist, take me through a few of your images. How do they come into being? Let's have a look at one of perhaps the defining features of the Kate and Will's wedding, which is the commoner theme.
Yes, there's a scene with William being interviewed or interviewing his mother, and she's saying she's always proud of the fact that he looks like a horse, but she's asking how common is Kate. Anyway, the rest of the week strips is basically it's the Queen slumming it. I've done this thing for a long time, is having the Queen pretending to be common, speaking a regional accent. In this case, it's Liz and Phil are disporting themselves in the back garden of Buckingham Palace in an ornamental council house, or council heist, as the Queen would call it, picking at the whole idea of monarchy, which I do find objectionable anyway, the fact that we have this sort of hereditary institution laid before us, set down there to rule us.
And moving on to another image, you have his son, Prince Charles, with Diana. They look like they're headbanging, about to knock seven bells out of each other. And Diana is vomiting. Even eating disorders open to your humour, your sense of humour here.
It's taking the original romantic kiss from the royal wedding of 1981, the exact image, and just reworking it slightly. To deal with the bulimia in that way is rather cruel. Looking at it in retrospect, perhaps I wouldn't do that now. Gilray, the father of political cartooning, was doing much more ribald things than I would ever get away with back in the late 18th century.
And this is another image in the show.
Depiction of the young Prince of Wales, son of George III, who would later become George IV. He illegally married Mrs. Fitzherbert, who was a Catholic, who was his mistress. It was a secret. And here's Gilray exposing this at the time. So it's actually quite serious. It's serious sort of reportage, also serious satire. And there's the rather glamorous, voluptuous-looking Mrs. Fitzherbert. this kind of withering satire that I'd have a great difficulty getting away with some of that, the things that Gure was doing today.
More sophisticated drawings, perhaps more sophisticated than the cartoons now, much more like the William Hogarth painting that you imagine. In fact, we have a William Hogarth here, Marriage à la Mode.
Yeah, satirising the society marriage between a very rich young man and a very rich young woman. And it's about the sort of the way the whole relationship disintegrates. It starts off as a kind of brokered arrangement between two families. Point about Hogarth, and of course Gilray as well, is the images are absolutely sumptuous. They're fabulous. Hogarth originally painted in oils and then turned into an engraving. This is the engraving, which in itself is a sumptuous piece of sumptuous, beautiful object. I mean, there's things like Posey's views of marriage, which are much more contemporary, much more sour, if you like.
Posey Simmons, the cartoonist,
in The Guardian, who's asking the question, why marriage through the ages, starting back in the days of Ruritania, which of course never existed, through Victorian times, wartime, to the present.
Questions like, why are we getting married? Because we wanted to have a really great party.
Yeah, exactly, which is a fair reason. Cartooning is usually about causing offence and making fun. Glorifying something is perhaps not something that's in the lexicon. I think Posey's obviously being deeply ironic about marriage, and quite right too.
I'll post a slideshow that the BBC did from some of the exhibits.
That's great. I looked at it.
Yeah, there's some really, really nice ones.
And I tweeted it. And
what do you think of that? I mean, like, I spoke last week of how cartoons were a little bit of a shorthand in Japan, a very, very useful one. And it seems, again, they are here with the subject of marriage, something completely different, but yet they really get to an awful lot of social and cultural issues in this non-linguistic shorthand.
They are. I mean, I'm increasingly, maybe it's just because I do a lot with cartoons, but I'm just increasingly, it feels like we're possibly in the sort of a new sort of heyday of them. Mm. The web has changed the whole thing and been a real challenge to political cartoonists around the world, and many of them are now out of jobs and scratching their head. But on the other hand, it's this whole new platform that is also spreading them and their accessibility. So it's a funny time, but there's a lot of interesting things going on. Even, you know, the Japan thing. I mentioned this to you yesterday in the office. There's people who are communicating their experiences of the tsunami and earthquake and the fear over the reactors through manga. And, of course, that helps with the whole language thing. But it's a really interesting time. And, of course, in repressive regimes, or not even that repressive regimes, cartoons are a whole way of expressing things that you can't express otherwise, and people still getting in trouble.
It definitely is the thing that in Western democracies the responsible journalist will leave out of the article. And yet it's often the kind of ticking bomb. It's the thing that is the reason why it'll get to the very nub of the story. And as you say, in non-democracies, in autocracies, it plays a somewhat different role.
I saw this item, and I follow a lot of things about cartoonists, and one of them said a Libyan political cartoonist is being held along with thousands of other Libyans. And so I tracked it down. Turned out he's not a cartoonist, but he's an artist. And he's been rather tame and not terribly political. I talked to his brother who's in London, and we had his brother on the show yesterday, big show. But he is an artist, and even his art, which is not very political, he's been dragged in. So the visual arts period, encompassing graphic novels and cartooning and simply painting, you know, if you live in a repressive regime, you're fair game.
Yeah. Between, like, losing your job to the web and, you know, losing your freedom to various dictators,
one of the most famous political cartoonists in the world, Jonathan Shapiro, known as Zapiro in South Africa, he's facing, like, 3 or 4 lawsuits from the president of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, who feels like Zapiro has demeaned him and libeled him or whatever, defamed him. And Zapiro is defiant, saying, are you joking? This is my job. I'm a cartoonist. Come on. Right. Like, that was a program.
Right.
But it's a really important case. You know, it's a fledgling democracy. And it's sort of, is there room for satire or not? And so it's an issue that's, you know, there was a Slovakian cartoonist, a great cartoonist, and the president of Slovakia was going to sue him for making fun of him. And so this cartoonist took up billboards around the country putting up his cartoons.
It's just Don't they realize that the more sort of non-humorous these leaders are, the more they don't get it, the more cartoons are going to be? It's absurd. I mean, it's crazy.
But here's an interesting thing. Since the tragedies in Japan, I have been looking everywhere for Japanese political cartoonists. There aren't, and there are not a lot of them. That's not there. I found like the history of the political cartoon in Japan, you know, leading up to the Meiji period or something. Historically, Japan has a strong tradition of, you know, woodblock prints and artistry. And there was a period where there were cartoonists, but there are really virtually no political cartoonists in Japan right now. I don't know enough about it to know exactly why, but there are other visual forms in Japan, you know, manga and anime, and there's strong traditions, but the sort of the political cartoon in the newspaper or now online is just, it's kind of
doesn't
not,
exist.
No, and I think I'm going to explore that and maybe take that up in Global Cartoons about why that is, and the cartoons I'm publishing about the tragedy in Japan are by American or Brits who are based in Japan.
Oh, that's interesting.
And who do their cartoons for, like, the Japan Times. Mm. Or California-based people who are very involved in anime and manga and have comic strips. I don't even want to talk about it because I don't know enough to be authoritative or even pretend to be, which we do a lot here.
That hasn't stopped you.
Hey! but it's an interesting thing.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should actually mention at this point where to find your cartoons on the web.
Yes, you can find them at theworld.org/cartoons. You can also find them on Facebook, Global Political Cartoons. You can follow me on Twitter, at Global Cartoons. They're all over the place.
Mm. Well, after that advertising break, it's on to the final story, our number one story, and it's yours, Carol.
So this is about Arctic languages. And Arctic languages are themselves a collection of dialects of something else. There's language groups. It's a real complicated one. So here's the deal. They're grappling with how to build a spoken system and a written system that they can all understand. And there are differences in language policy between Canada, which has a large Arctic community, and has Nunavut, their latest territory, and in Nunavut it's like, yeah, we got our territory, we're gonna require people speak, you know, our language by 2008 or whatever. So there's a lot of kind of Arctic chauvinism, because Nunavut is sort of this showcase of, here we have a government. You know, we're part of this large thing. We've got our territory. We've got a territorial government. We have somebody sitting in the Canadian Parliament.
It's a territory, not a province.
Right. Mm. And I don't know the technical difference. Yeah. But I think they do still have reps in Ottawa.
Yeah.
So as you might expect, the attempts at standardizing Arctic languages have come from missionaries. Joe Blow missionary in the 19th century, Joe Blow missionary, or somebody part of the church in the 20th. So there was a whole language conference recently in Nunavut, in Iqaluit, the largest town. How to create a form of the Inuit language, which is broadly means the collection of dialects spoken across the Arctic that everyone can comprehend throughout the territories.
And these are presumably between groups of people who, aside from these leaders who show up at these conferences, would never ever set eyes on each other because they're thousands of miles away. I mean,
right.
One Greenland to Alaska.
Right.
I mean, we're talking huge, huge distances.
I saw this article and I just had to laugh. Listen to this quote. "We have to be understandable in all dialects to everyone," says Elijah Urklu, chair of the Inuit Ukwasinganik Taigwasikalikwatwik Language Authority.
Wow.
Wow. Okay, there's 29 letters in the name of the language authority. I'm not pronouncing it right. Apologies to all Arctic language speakers. Ukwasinganik Taigwasikalikwatwik Language Authority. The impetus for this is the government of Nunavut. Mm. Like, they have this authority now to standardize, now that they, you know, have their own government.
And do they want to? I mean, if the missionaries started it, have they picked it up and
Well, what's interesting is that, of course, they're setting up a lot of committees to you know, chew this stuff
Nothing
over.
Like a good committee.
The proper terms should be chosen and researched and agreed upon by terminology committees. Sounds Orwellian. There should not be disagreement over the Inuit language, Urklu said. There are two written systems in this area, and one of them is the Roman alphabet, and that is more predominant in sort of the American Arctic areas mm-hmm. and certain parts of the Canadian Arctic areas. And then there's a syllabic system. Both were separately introduced by, I think, certainly the first, the Roman orthographic was a late 19th century missionary thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell about the syllabic system. It was developed by a person who's still alive, a non-Arctic person who's lived there for 30 or 40 years. And I don't know whether he originally got there through the church or not. The syllabic system, that's used nearly universally throughout Nunavik and eastern Nunavut. And the syllabic system, I did a lot of searches on this. It's a tough one to even talk about because I didn't have the right software to look at it.
Mm.
But essentially, I think it's letters to or figures to represent syllables as opposed to sort of syllables and tones. Try as I might, I was trying to look up, you know, Wikipedia, I couldn't quite figure it out. I did see a picture of it, which I'll show you.
Wow. If that person is still alive, that means that this was subsequent to the Romanization effort, which implies that the Romanization effort didn't quite convey the language as richly as maybe it deserved.
When what's interesting is that the syllabic system that they used was adapted from the Cree syllabic system in the late 19th century by missionaries from England. So all of these are things that are brought from without.
Borrowed from other languages.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And since 1976, in the Canadian parts of the Arctic, they've approved the two standardized writing systems, the syllabic one and the Latin one. So now they're trying to just come to some agreement and have one. And have one that everybody understands.
Well, that'll take another 30 years.
So they not only need to agree on the system, they need to agree on words and phrases.
Good luck with that. And, of course, in Canada, I mean, they have many, many language institutions already in place, unlike here. I mean, the Canadians sort of have a language policy in a way that, I have to say, listeners, that Carol is now showing me the...
This is the syllabic system.
The syllabic system, yeah. That
it looks more like Bengali or something.
Yeah, or it's hieroglyphic or something. Ooh.
There's a chart. It shows the squiggles, lots of squiggles, and what each squiggle means in the Roman alphabet. Then it has a transliteration into the Roman alphabet, and then it has an English translation.
All right, we'll post that.
It's an interesting one, and it's complicated. And Canada, they have time for these kind of things. They can... Sorry. Well, but they can set up committees and do this and focus on this. It's like a lot of things in the Arctic, in northern areas. They're small populations, but the issues are kind of vital.
You right.
know, it's like the role of public radio in Alaska historically, you know, yeah. stations serving 12 people. But yeah. but its function was vital. So
yeah.
language is this vital thing. And yes, they're small populations dispersed, but it's like language. It's
right.
communication. So it's,
right.
it's this primal thing. So right. it's very interesting.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Well, Carol, thank you very much. That's fantastic. We've been around the linguistic world today.
I tried desperately to get audio samples of Iqaluit, and I couldn't. There's supposed to be a live channel, but I couldn't access it. Maybe it's just from some computers. But listeners, if you've got examples of audio versions of Inuktitut language, which is broadly the name of the different Arctic dialects that are spoken in various parts of the Arctic.
Yeah, send them my way. That would be great. There's always another podcast for that.
Mm.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Carol.
You're welcome, Patrick. Always a pleasure.
I'll do the usual thing and post links and a few other thoughts at theworld.org/language, also at patrickcox.wordpress.com. Don't forget, you can post your comments at the World in Words Facebook page or tweet me. My handle is Patrick Cox, PatriCox. And, of course, you can email me. The address is language@pri.org. Talk next week.